Everyone, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, it's honestly a fantastic resource,
right?
Especially for what we are tearing apart today.
Exactly. So listen up. You are prepping for the Series 66, and today we are absolutely destroying the topic of types of pooled investments. I mean, looking at the syllabus, this is a massive chunk of a 17 question section on the exam.
Right. It is not a footnote. Pooled investments are basically the backbone of your future clients' portfolios.
And that's the whole mission of this deep dive. The exam wants to know if you, as a future investment advisor representative, can actually match the right financial vehicle to a client's specific liquidity needs, their risk tolerance, and their tax situation.
Because putting the wrong client into the wrong investment pool isn't just, you know, a minor compliance thing. It can literally destroy their financial life.
Totally. And to make sure this actually sticks in your brain, we are not going to just read boring textbook definitions. There's a guaranteed way to zone out.
Yeah, nobody learns that way.
Right. So we are bringing in a cast of characters, three recurring fictional clients. We'll run them through these different investment vehicles to see what actually happens. So client number one, meet Anxious Andy.
I love Anxious Andy.
He's great, but he's a mess. Andy is the guy who checks his portfolio app like 14 times before lunch. He's sweating bullets over every news headline. He needs his cash yesterday, and he absolutely hates having his money tied up.
So Anxious Andy is our baseline for pure, frictionless liquidity. He needs immediate access to his capital at all times.
Exactly. Client number two is billionaire Betty. Betty is loaded. She qualifies for all those exclusive, behind-the-velvet-rope private deals. She loves high risk. She wants massive rewards. And she honestly doesn't care if she has to wait a decade for a payout.
Right. She has plenty of cash elsewhere. So Betty represents the accredited investor. High risk tolerance, very low liquidity needs. She's playing outside the standard SEC sandbox.
Which brings us to client number three, cautious Carl. Carl is a pragmatist. He hates surprises. He despises high Wall Street fees, and he wants to know exactly what he owns and exactly when the investment timeline ends.
Carl just wants transparency and predictability. No hotshot managers day trading his retirement money.
Okay, Andy, Betty, and Carl, keep them in your head. Let's start with the most common pool on the planet, which is mutual funds. But right out of the gate, the exam loves to split this into two distinct structures.
Yeah, the great divide. Open-end management companies versus closed-end management companies.
So let's tackle open-end funds first. Because when normal people say mutual fund, this is almost always what they mean. I like to picture the open-end fund like an endless restaurant buffet.
An endless buffet. Okay, I like that.
Right. There's no fixed number of shares. It's just a continuous, never-ending offering. As long as people keep walking through the front door with cash, the kitchen just keeps cooking more food.
Exactly. That continuous offering is the core mechanical trade. The actual share count of the fund goes up and down every single day.
So if Anxious Andy wants to invest 50 grand today, the mutual fund literally just creates brand new shares out of thin air to hand him.
Yes. And tomorrow, when Andy inevitably panics and wants his money back, he goes directly back to the fund. They redeem his shares, hand him his cash, and those specific shares are destroyed. They just cease to exist.
Okay, but at what price? If shares are just constantly popping into and out of existence, how do we know what a single share is actually worth?
They're priced at net asset value, or NAV.
Break down that NAV formula for us, because I know that's heavily tested.
It's actually a very clean formula. The NAV is the true mathematical value of one share. You take the fund's total asset, so every single stock, bond, and dollar of cash it holds. Then you subtract the total liabilities. That's any debts or management fees owed. That gives you the total net worth of the whole fund. Finally, you divide that net worth by the total number of shares outstanding.
Total assets minus total liabilities divided by shares outstanding. Simple enough.
It is. But here is the catch. That massive calculation across billions of dollars of assets only happens exactly once per day.
Right.
And it always happens after the major U.S. markets close, usually around 4 p.m. Eastern time.
Okay, stop right here. Listener, I am talking directly to you. This is where the exam tries to trap you. Let's test this in the real world. Pause for a beat and think about this after I ask.
Let's hear it.
Anxious Andy is having a terrible Tuesday morning. The market opens. It's a bloodbath. Stocks are tanking. At exactly 10 a.m., Andy logs into his brokerage account and slams the sell button on his open-end mutual fund. Does Andy lock in the price of his fund at 10 a.m.?
He absolutely does not.
But it feels like he should. Like, if I sell Apple stock at 10 a.m., I get the 10 a.m. price. Why is the mutual fund different?
Because of SEC Rule 22C1, you need to know this as forward pricing.
Forward pricing. Okay, how does that screw Andy over?
Well, when Andy hits sell at 10 a.m., the mutual fund just receives the order and says, okay, Andy, we got your request. We will execute it at the very next calculated net asset value.
And since that NAV calculation doesn't happen until 4 p.m.
Exactly. Andy is locked into whatever that end-of-day price turns out to be. He's flying totally blind for 6 hours.
That is wild. The market could plummet another 1,000 points and he's just stuck waiting. He cannot lock in a current price, and he definitely can't lock in a past price.
Right. Every single order, buying or selling, executes at the next calculated NAV. The SEC instituted this to prevent arbitrage.
What do you mean by arbitrage in this context?
Well, if forward pricing didn't exist, a savvy trader could watch the market go up all morning, buy mutual fund shares at yesterday's lower stale price, and immediately capture a risk-free profit.
Oh, wow. And that profit would just be siphoned directly out of the pockets of the existing buy-and-hold investors.
Exactly. Forward pricing levels the playing field. Whether you place your order at 9:30 in the morning or 3:59 in the afternoon, everyone gets the exact same end-of-day price.
Okay, that makes total sense. Now, before we pivot away from open-end funds, there's a vocabulary gotcha I want to flag. The term closed fund. My brain instantly wants to say a closed fund is just a closed-end fund.
And that is exactly what the test writers are hoping you'll do. But it is totally incorrect.
So what is a closed fund then?
A closed fund is just a standard open-end mutual fund that has become too massive. The portfolio manager might have, say, $10 billion under management, and they literally cannot find enough good stocks to buy without distorting the market.
Ah, okay. So going back to the restaurant analogy, a closed fund is just the endless buffet temporarily locking its front doors because it hit maximum fire code capacity?
That's a perfect analogy. The current customers are still eating, the kitchen is still cooking, and existing investors can still redeem their shares. They just aren't letting any new money walk in. It's a temporary operational status.
Got it. Whereas a closed-end fund is a permanent structural classification.
Exactly.
So let's dig into that structure. If the open-end fund is the endless buffet, a closed-end fund operates way more like a limited edition sneaker drop.
The sneaker drop analogy is spot on for their IPO process. With a closed-end fund, they raise capital exactly once. They file for an initial public offering, and they say to the public, we are creating exactly 10 million shares. Who wants them?
Investors buy in, the fund collects the cash, and then the sneaker drop is over.
The door is locked. They will never create another new share of that specific fund. And crucially, they will never redeem your shares either.
Wait, really? So what happens to anxious Andy? Let's say he bought into the IPO, but 3 weeks later he gets spooked by the news and wants his cash back. Is he just trapped?
He's not trapped,
But
he has to find his own exit. He has to take his limited edition sneakers to the secondary market. He logs into his brokerage account and finds another investor out in the real world who wants to buy those shares from him.
He's trading on a stock exchange.
Yes. Closed-end funds trade publicly on major exchanges like the NYSE or NASDAQ, exactly like shares of Microsoft or Apple. You buy and sell them intraday at whatever the current market price happens to be.
Which completely changes the pricing mechanics. With open-end, the price was rigidly tied to that 4 p.m. NAV calculation. But if a closed-end fund is trading on an exchange, isn't the price just dictated by supply and demand?
Precisely. And this introduces a massively tested concept, the premium and discount rule.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because closed-end funds trade based on market hype, their short price can detach completely from the actual mathematical NAV of their portfolio.
So the raw materials in the sneakers might only be worth $100. That's the NAV. But because everyone is hyped about the drop, the market bids the price up to like $120.
That's it. When the market price is higher than the NAV, the fund is trading at a premium. But if the market hates the fund's strategy and everyone is panic selling, the share price might plummet to $80, even though the underlying stocks are still worth $100.
And that would be trading at a discount.
Right. When the market price is lower than the NAV, it's a discount.
Okay, listener, let's lock this down. If an exam question describes a fund trading at a premium or a discount to its NAV, what kind of fund must it be? Think about it.
It has to be a closed-end fund.
Exactly. Because open-end funds only ever transact at the exact NAV, they can never trade at a premium or discount.
That is a definitive rule you can rely on. Also, closed-end funds can use leverage, which is another big distinction.
Leverage, meaning they borrow money to invest.
Yeah. Because closed-end funds don't have to worry about anxious Andy showing up demanding his money back tomorrow. They have a stable pool of capital. They can go to a bank, borrow another $20 million, and amplify their investments.
Which amplifies their gains, but also their losses.
Exactly. It makes them much riskier. Open-end mutual funds generally cannot use structural leverage like that.
Let's do a rapid-fire compare side-by-side to synthesize this. I'll throw out a feature. You tell me where it belongs. Where do the shares actually trade?
Open-end funds trade directly with the fund sponsor. Closed-end funds trade on a secondary stock exchange.
Nice. What is the price?
Open-end is strictly the NAV, once a day. Closed-end is the market price, fluctuating continuously intraday.
Which one uses forward pricing?
Open-end funds only.
And which one has a fixed, limited supply of shares?
Closed-end funds, born from a single IPO. Open-end funds are the continuous, unlimited buffet.
Beautiful. So if anxious Andy wants to hit sell at 11:14 a.m. and know his exact price immediately, an open-end mutual fund is going to make him miserable.
Oh, he'd hate the forward pricing. He wants a closed-end fund for that intraday control.
But wait, what if Andy comes to us and says, hey, I want the massive diversification of an open-end fund. I want to trade it at 11:14 a.m. like a closed-end fund, but I absolutely do not want to deal with those crazy premiums and discounts. I want the price anchored to reality.
He's asking for a vehicle that basically solves the flaws of both structures.
Right.
He wants an exchange-traded fund, an ETF.
Enter the ETF. I always think of ETFs as a financial Frankenstein. They literally took the best parts of open-end and closed-end funds and stitched them together.
It really is the perfect hybrid. Like closed-end funds, ETFs trade intraday on major stock exchanges. You can buy and sell them all day. You can sell them short. You can buy them on margin.
Total trading flexibility, which Andy loves. But what about the management style? Are there guys in suits picking stocks all day?
Mostly, no. While active ETFs do exist, the vast majority are passively managed. They just track a specific index, like the S&P 500.
Which means they don't have to pay a team of analysts millions of dollars, so the internal fees are incredibly low.
Exactly.
Cautious Carl loves that. Low fees, total transparency. But hold on, I have a logical problem here. You just said ETFs trade on an exchange at market prices based on supply and demand, just like closed-end funds.
Right.
So if a million people suddenly buy the S&P 500 ETF at 2 p.m., shouldn't that massive demand spike drive the price way above the NAV? Shouldn't ETFs suffer from the exact same premium and discount volatility?
They logically should, but they don't. And understanding why they don't is arguably the most important ETF concept for the Series 66.
Okay, let's pop the hood on this. How does the engine work?
The secret engine is called creation and redemption, and it's operated by a highly specialized player called an authorized participant, or an AP.
Listener, huge red flag here. The exam will try to trick you on who an authorized participant can be. Let me be extremely clear. An AP is a massive institutional broker-dealer. It's a Goldman Sachs or a JP Morgan. It is never an individual retail investor.
That's a vital distinction. Anxious Andy cannot be an AP. Even billionaire Betty cannot be an AP. Retail investors can only buy and sell existing ETF shares on the secondary market.
Only the massive APs have the legal agreement to interact directly with the ETF sponsor to create or redeem brand new shares. So give me the physical analogy. How did this actually work?
Visualize the AP as a massive trading desk. They want to create new shares of an S&P 500 ETF. They don't just hand the sponsor a check. Instead, the AP goes into the open stock market and physically buys up the exact correct proportion of all 500 underlying stocks.
Millions of dollars of Apple, Microsoft, Amazon.
Right. They put all those shares into a giant metaphorical basket.
So the AP is basically doing the grocery shopping for the exact ingredients of the ETF.
Precisely. The AP takes that heavy basket of stocks, hands it directly to the ETF sponsor, and in exchange, the sponsor hands the AP a newly minted block of ETF shares. This block is called a creation unit, usually like 50,000 ETF shares at a time.
It's a barter system, raw stocks for finished ETF shares.
And if they want to reverse it...
That's redemption. The AP hands the 50,000 ETF shares back to the sponsor. The sponsor hands back the giant basket of underlying stocks, and the ETF shares are destroyed.
Okay, the barter system is cool, but how does this stop the ETF from trading at a massive premium or discount? It relies entirely on the AP's greed. It's an arbitrage meat grinder. Let's say retail investors are panic buying the ETF, pushing the market price up to $105 a share. But the actual mathematical NAV of the underlying stocks is only $100.
So the ETF is trading at a $5 premium. It's overpriced.
Instantly, The AP's trading algorithms spot this. They see risk-free arbitrage. The AP goes into the stock market, buys the underlying basket of stocks for their true value of $100, hands that basket to the ETF sponsor, and gets a brand new creation unit of ETF shares.
And what do they do with those brand new shares?
They immediately turn around and dump them onto the stock exchange, selling them to the retail crowd for that inflated price of $105.
Wow. They just pocketed a risk-free $5 profit on every single share, doing it in blocks of 50,000. That's insane money.
It is.
Yeah.
But think about the economic impact. By constantly creating new shares and dumping them on the exchange, the AP is massively increasing the supply of the ETFs.
And when supply floods a market, the price drops.
Exactly. The AP will ruthlessly continue this arbitrage until the sheer weight of the new supply crushes the market price of the ETF right back down to its true $100 NAV. The moment the premium vanishes, the arbitrage is over and the AP stops.
That is incredibly elegant. The AP gets rich skimming pennies, but as a byproduct of their greed, they act as a gravitational force pulling the ETF's price back in line with its NAV.
Yep. And it works the exact same way during a market panic when the ETF drops to a discount. The AP buys the cheap ETF shares, redeems them for the more valuable underlying stocks, pockets the profit, and by buying up the ETF shares, they reduce supply and drive the price back up.
So if the exam asks how an ETF price stays so close to its NAV, the answer is the creation and redemption process utilized by authorized participants.
Exactly. But price stability is only half the magic. The other half is the ultimate selling point for ETFs, unparalleled tax efficiency.
Oh, man. Okay, listener, I'm asking you a direct question. Pause and think about this. The exam will ask you, WHY, exchange-traded funds, are more tax efficient than standard open-end mutual funds. Is it because ETFs primarily track passive indexes, which means they trade less often?
It is such a tempting answer, but it is entirely incorrect.
But it sounds so logical. Less trading should mean fewer taxes, right? Why is that wrong?
Because think about an index mutual fund. It tracks the exact same S&P 500 index as the ETF. It has the exact same low turnover rate. Yet, structurally, that index mutual fund is still significantly less tax efficient than its ETF counterpart.
So just tracking an index cannot be the root cause.
Right. To understand why, we have to look at the nightmare scenario of an open-end mutual fund. Why does it generate surprise tax bills?
Right. Let's bring back Andy and Carl. They both have $1 million in the same open-end mutual fund. The market gets volatile. Anxious Andy panics, and he demands a full redemption. He wants his $1 million in cash today.
And the mutual fund manager says, Andy, I don't have $1 million in cash just sitting around. I'm fully invested in the market. To raise your cash, I am forced to go into the open market and physically sell $1 million worth of our best performing stocks.
And in the U.S. tax code, selling an appreciated asset triggers a realized capital gain.
Yes. But here is the brutal part. The mutual fund entity itself does not pay the taxes on that gain. By law, they must pass all realized capital gains down to their shareholders at the end of the year.
Wait, but Andy sold his shares and bailed in July. Who is left holding the bag?
Cautious Carl. Carl did absolutely nothing. He didn't sell a single share. But because Andy panicked and forced the manager to sell stocks, Carl gets hit with a massive taxable capital gains distribution in December.
That is so infuriating. In a mutual fund, the behavior of other investors actively harms your personal taxes.
That's a huge flaw. So how does the ETF structure solve this? It goes back to the authorized participant and that barter system.
Okay, walk me through it.
When an AP wants to redeem a massive block of ETF shares, they don't ask the sponsor to sell stocks and give them cash. They hand over the ETF shares, and the sponsor simply hands them back the actual physical stock certificates, the underlying basket.
The sponsor just literally slides the shares of Apple and Microsoft across the table.
Yes. This is known as an in-kind transaction. Because the sponsor is simply exchanging shares for securities in a barter arrangement, rather than actually selling the securities for cash, the IRS does not consider it a taxable event for the fund.
Oh, wow. No forced selling equals no realized capital gain.
Exactly. No realized gain for the fund means no surprise capital gains distributions passed down to the long-term ETF holders. Cautious Carl is completely protected from Anxious Andy's panic selling.
The AP just absorbs the tax basis of those underlying stocks, and the ETF washes its hands of the liability. That is brilliant. So listener, if the exam asks why ETFs are tax efficient, ignore any answer about tracking an index. The only correct answer involves the in-kind creation and redemption process.
You've got it. That's the key.
Okay, looking at our notes, there's a very specific type of pool that seems kind of old school, but it's heavily tested. Let's say cautious Carl comes to us. He says, look, I understand mutual funds and ETFs, but I don't want an active manager. And honestly, I don't even want an index ETF because indexes change companies all the time.
He wants something static.
Exactly. He says, I want a very specific, unchanging pool of investments, zero ongoing management, so my fees are basically zero. And most importantly, I want a guaranteed expiration date so I know exactly when this entire investment ends.
If Carl wants an unmanaged buy and hold time capsule, he is looking for a unit investment trust, a UIT.
A unit investment trust. Let's break this down because the mechanics are fundamentally different.
The defining characteristic of a UIT is that it is completely static. When an institution sponsors a UIT, they select a specific portfolio, let's say 50 different municipal bonds. They lock those exact 50 bonds into a legal trust, issue units to investors, and then they walk away.
Wait, they just leave it. There's nobody checking the markets every morning.
No active portfolio manager at all. No ongoing trading. The trust just holds those exact 50 bonds, collects the interest, passes it to the investors, and waits.
Carl would absolutely love this. He reads the prospectus on day one, sees the 50 bonds, and knows with 100% certainty that those are the exact bonds he'll own for the entire life of the investment.
Total transparency. And because there's no highly paid manager making daily decisions, the fees are razor thin.
But the feature that truly separates the UIT, the thing the exam will use to identify it, is that termination date.
Yes. A UIT is inherently self-liquidating. It has a built-in mandatory expiration date. On that specific date, the time capsule automatically opens, the trust terminates, any remaining securities are sold off or mature, and the final cash is distributed pro rata to the unit holders.
Carl gets his final check, the trust dies, everyone goes home. Very predictable. Okay, but I see a few sneaky exam traps hitting in here. Trap number one. Almost every time someone explains a UIT, they use bonds as the example. Even you just use municipal bonds. Does a UIP only hold bonds?
It's a terrible habit in finance education, and it creates a massive blind spot. Listener, write this down. UITs can hold stocks or our bonds.
Do not fall for the trick that they are fixed income only.
Exactly. You can absolutely buy an equity UIT. A sponsor might lock 30 blue chip dividend stocks in a trust for 5 years. The defining feature is the fixed portfolio, not the asset class.
Got it. Trap number two. We keep saying it's not actively managed and the sponsor just walks away. But what if disaster strikes? What if one of those 30 companies is caught in a massive fraud scandal in year two and is clearly going bankrupt? Is the trust legally forced to just watch the stock go to zero?
Important nuance here. Not actively managed means no day-to-day trading trying to beat the market. However, there is still a trustee overseeing administration. If a security becomes fundamentally impaired, like declaring bankruptcy or hard default, the trustee does have the fiduciary power to step in and dump that specific security to protect investors from total ruin.
Okay, so it's a static portfolio, but they have an emergency ejector button.
Yes, strictly an exception for extreme distress. Not a license to trade on bad earnings reports.
Right. Okay, final UIT trap, and this requires a careful side-by-side comparison. Liquidity. What happens if cautious Carl buys a 10-year UIT, but in year five, he has a medical emergency and needs his money back immediately? Are his funds locked up?
No, they aren't locked up. UIT units are legally redeemable. Carl can sell his units directly back to the trust sponsor at their current net asset value, very similar to an open-end mutual fund.
Ah, so a UIT is technically a type of open-end fund?
No, and that is exactly where the exam will try to trap you. A UIT is redeemable at NAV, yes, but it's fundamentally not an open-end management company.
Walk me through the distinction, because from the outside, they look identical.
An open-end mutual fund is actively managed, its portfolio is constantly changing, and it theoretically lives forever. No end date. A UIT is an unmanaged, static portfolio that has a legally mandated death date.
Fixed portfolio plus termination date equals unit investment trust. That is the formula. Do not let the redeemable aspect trick you.
It is the most reliable way to identify them on the test.
All right, let's take a breath and shift gears entirely. Everything we've discussed so far, mutual funds, ETFs, UITs, all operate under the Investment Company Act of 1940. Heavily regulated by the SEC, massive disclosures available to the general public. Anxious Andy can buy any of these with $100.
Right.
But what happens when billionaire Betty gets bored of the highly regulated public markets? What happens when she wants to play outside the SEC's strict playground?
We cross the velvet rope into private funds. And the absolute first thing you need to grasp for the exam is who the gatekeepers actually let into this club.
Because anxious Andy and his $100 are definitely not getting past the bouncer.
Not a chance. Private funds rely on specific legal exemptions from the 1940 Act. To keep that unregulated status, they are legally prohibited from offering shares to the general public. They can't run TV ads, and they can't take money from retail investors.
Who is on the VIP list?
The exam uses terms like accredited investors and qualified purchasers. We are talking about individuals with massive high net worths, consistent high six-figure incomes, or huge institutional investors, like university endowments.
So billionaire Betty.
Exactly. The SEC's philosophy is simple. These investors are wealthy and sophisticated. They can evaluate complex risks, and more importantly, they can absorb massive financial losses without becoming a burden on the state. The SEC basically says, fine, you don't need our protection. Have at it.
But what does losing that protection mean for the fund managers? What can they do that a mutual fund manager can't?
It removes almost all the guardrails. Less oversight, highly limited disclosure requirements, they don't have to publish their trades or calculate a daily NAV, and crucially, they can impose severe restrictions on liquidity. Once you give them your money, it's very hard to get it back in your timeline.
The velvet rope is tight. Let's look at the specific rooms inside this club, starting with the most infamous, hedge funds. The Wild West of Wall Street.
Hedge funds are aggressively managed private pools that use highly advanced, extremely risky strategies to pursue massive absolute returns. Because they're exempt from the 1940 Act, they use tactics that would make a mutual fund compliance officer pass out.
Like what? Give me some examples.
They're short-selling massive amounts of stock, betting companies will fail. They use extreme leverage, borrowing huge sums from prime brokers. They trade complex derivatives. And they make highly concentrated bets, maybe putting 30% of the fund into a single obscure asset.
Which sounds terrifying to Andy, but Betty loves the thrill. Now, structurally, how are these organized? Because I see a major exam gotcha in the notes. Are hedge funds standard corporations?
Almost never. For tax and liability reasons, hedge funds are organized as limited partnerships.
Break down those roles. Who does what?
The hedge fund manager, the supposed genius making the trades, acts as the general partner. They run the business, make the investments, and take on the unlimited legal liability. Billionaire Betty, who just writes the massive check, enters as a limited partner.
What does limited status actually mean for her?
It means she has absolutely no say in day-to-day management. She can't demand they buy Apple stock, but her financial liability is strictly limited to her invested capital.
So if she invests $10 million, the worst that happens is it goes to zero. But if the general partner gets sued for $100 million, creditors cannot come after Betty's personal yachts.
Exactly. The structure protects her outside assets.
All right, let's talk compensation, because this is why people start hedge funds. This is not cautious Carl paying 0.05% for an ETF.
Not even in the same universe.
Yeah.
Hedge funds famously operate on the 2 and 20 fee structure.
Let's do the math on 2 and 20.
The 2 represents a 2% annual management fee on total assets under management. This is just to keep the lights on, and it's charged no matter what. If Betty gives them $10 million, they take $200,000 every year just for existing, even if they lose money.
2% just to show up. And the 20.
The 20 is the performance fee. The manager takes 20% of all the actual profits they generate. That's the incentive to swing for the fences.
Okay, let's pause and apply some logic. Betty didn't become a billionaire by letting people rip her off. Hypothetical scenario. Year one, the manager makes terrible bets. The fund drops from a peak of $100 million down to $50 million. Year two, they have a phenomenal year, make 100% return, and bring the fund from $50 million back up to $100 million. Technically, they generated $50 million in profit in year two. Does the manager get a 20% cut of that?
Brilliant question. Mm. This highlights a massively testable concept, the high watermark. Betty would be furious if she had to pay a massive fee just for the manager digging themselves out of a hole they created.
Right.
So almost all reputable hedge funds use a high watermark. It's simply the highest peak value the fund has ever achieved. The rule is the manager can only charge the 20% fee on new W profits that push the fund above that historical high watermark.
So in my scenario, the high watermark was $100 million. Even though they made $50 million in year two, they just got back to the high watermark. It was just recovery. So they get zero performance fee.
Exactly. Betty won't pay them twice for the same initial capital. They have to push the fund to $101 million before they start taking a cut again.
Such a crucial concept. Now, what about liquidity? If Betty needs $5 million for a real estate deal, can she just call the manager and get a wire transfer?
Almost certainly not. Hedge funds enforce strict lockup periods. When you first invest, your money is completely frozen, often for 1 to 2 years. You cannot touch it. And even after that, you don't have daily liquidity.
How often can you get out?
Usually only during specific redemption windows, maybe once a quarter. And you have to give 30 to 90 days written notice so they have time to sell off illiquid assets.
Functionally illiquid. Got it. Okay, let's say Betty doesn't want to trade public stocks at all. She wants to buy actual physical companies. That brings us to private equity and venture capital.
Right. Private equity, or PE, is a completely different beast. They aren't staring at Bloomberg terminals timing the stock market. They are buying established, fully operating companies. They buy massive private companies, or they buy struggling public companies and take them private.
What's the goal? Why buy a struggling manufacturing plant?
Aggressive operational restructuring. They fire the old board, bring in ruthless executives, cut costs to the bone, streamline the supply chain, and try to make the company highly profitable over 5 to 10 years. Then they sell it for a massive profit.
How do they exit?
Three main routes. A new IPO, selling to a massive corporate buyer in the same industry, or a secondary buyout to another larger PE firm.
Okay, so PE is buying established cash-flowing businesses. Where does venture capital fit in? Our notes group them together. Are they the same thing?
Vital clarification. Venture capital, or VC, is technically a specific subset operating underneath the broader private equity umbrella.
Okay, so simplify this for the listener. VC is basically just private equity for babies.
I mean, that's a very colorful way to put it, but yeah, it's not totally inaccurate.
It makes sense. Instead of buying a 40-year-old manufacturing plant, VC funds are investing in early-stage startups. Two kids in a garage with a laptop and a dream.
And because of that, the risk profile of VC is astronomically higher. Traditional PE buys a company with actual revenues. VC buys an unproven idea that will burn cash for 5 years before seeing a dime. The vast majority of VC portfolio companies will fail completely and go to zero.
So how do they make any money?
The power law. They expect 8 out of 10 to fail. But they are hunting for those one or two massive home runs. If a VC fund was the seed investor in Uber or Airbnb, that single win returns 100 times the capital, covers all the losses, and drives a massive overall return.
Do the VC managers just write a check and hope for the best?
Never. VC is highly hands-on. They demand board seats, provide intense strategic guidance, force founders to hire real executives, and use their Rolodex to find the startup's first major customers.
Okay, I have a massive direct question for the listener. This gets into the structural plumbing, and the exam loves to test this. Pause and think. Billionaire Betty commits $10 million to a new hedge fund and $10 million to a new private equity fund. How does her money actually physically move into those funds? Is it the exact same process?
It is entirely different. Misunderstanding this will definitely cost you points.
Walk through the hedge fund first.
When Betty signs the paperwork for the hedge fund, she wires them the full $10 million on day one. They take it all, begin trading with it immediately, and apply that strict lockup period, all the money up front.
Okay. How does the private equity fund handle it?
PE and VC use a completely different structure known as capital calls. Think about what a PE firm does. They have to hunt for entire companies to buy. They don't know exactly when they'll close the deal. If they demanded Betty's $10 million on day one, it might just sit in a checking account earning 1% for 2 years while they scour the earth for a manufacturing plant.
And Betty would hate that cash drag.
Exactly. So instead, the PE fund has Betty sign a legally binding document committing $10 million over the life of the fund. It's a promise. But Betty keeps the actual cash in her own accounts, investing it in short-term liquid vehicles.
So when do they actually get her money?
6 months later, when the PE firm finally negotiates a buyout and needs cash to close, they issue a formal capital call. They call Betty and say, hey, we are closing a deal on Friday. We're officially calling $2 million of your commitment.
And then she wires just the $2
million. Right. And over the next 3 to 5 years, as they find more companies, they will issue rolling capital calls, drawing the money down in chunks until the full $10 million is deployed.
Massive operational difference. Hedge funds take all capital up front and lock it up. PE relies on committed capital and uses capital calls over time.
Both restrict liquidity, but the mechanical pathways are completely distinct.
Before we leave private markets, PE fees. Do they use the 2 and 20 model?
Yes, very standard. But with PE, there is a distinct nuance regarding the 20% performance fee. they typically use what is called a hurdle rate.
What's the hurdle rate?
It's a legally defined minimum annual return, let's say 8%, that the PE fund must generate for Betty before the managers can take their 20% cut. The logic is Betty could easily earn 5% in basic index funds. She shouldn't pay a massive performance fee unless they are significantly beating what she could do alone.
So if the PE fund only generates a 6% return,
Betty keeps all the profit. The manager failed to clear the 8% hurdle rate, so they get zero performance fee on that capital.
I love that. Built-in required competence. Okay, let's take a hard pivot. We've done stocks, bonds, startups, corporate buyouts. Let's talk about real estate. Specifically, how our source would suggest owning real estate without having to drive to a duplex at 3 a.m. to fix a toilet.
We are entering the domain of the Real Estate Investment Trust, universally known as a REIT.
A REIT is brilliant. It gives everyday investors like Andy and Carl access to massive commercial real estate office buildings, shopping malls, hospitals, without needing millions of dollars or dealing with property management.
It democratizes commercial real estate. But to be legally classified as a REIT by the IRS and get the tax benefits, they have to follow very strict operational rules.
And there is one golden rule, the magic number, that is tested relentlessly.
To maintain tax advantage status, a REIT must distribute at least 90% of its taxable income to its shareholders in the form of dividends every single year.
90%. They are legally mandated to just push almost all the rent checks they collect straight out the door into the investor's pocket.
Exactly. And the incentive is massive. By pushing the income out, the REIT entity itself avoids paying corporate income taxes on those earnings. They avoid double taxation.
Okay, here is a massive trap. Listener, listen to me very carefully right now. Because REITs pay massive dividends and avoid corporate taxes, people assume a REIT is a highly tax-friendly investment. Let's test that. How are those massive REIT dividends actually taxed when they land in anxious Andy's brokerage account? Think about it. Do they get the favorable qualified dividend tax rate?
I will deliver the bad news. They absolutely do not. REIT dividends are taxed at the investor's ordinary income tax rate.
Ordinary income. That is the exact same absolute highest tax bracket that your regular salary gets hit with.
Yes. The exam will try to bait you with phrases like tax advantage structure. The structure is incredibly tax advantage at the corporate level, but at the investor level, it is brutal. Because the corporation didn't pay taxes, the IRS demands its pound of flesh from the investor. It hits your personal tax return with the full force of ordinary income.
So if Andy is a high earner in the 37% tax bracket, putting a REIT in his standard taxable account is a terrible idea. Half his yield vanishes.
Precisely. You generally want to place REITs inside tax-sheltered accounts, like an IRA, where those massive dividends can compound tax-free. The exam loves testing tax location like that.
All right, let's look at the flavors of REITs. Two distinct categories with vastly different risk profiles. Exchange-listed REITs versus non-traded REITs.
Exchange-listed REITs are straightforward. They trade publicly on major stock exchanges, like the NYSE.
So liquidity is fantastic.
Very liquid. You can buy and sell them instantaneously. The caveat is correlation risk. Because they are publicly traded, their price movements are heavily tied to broader stock market volatility. If the S&P 500 drops 5%, your listed REIT will likely drop in sympathy, even if the underlying buildings are fully leased.
You trade liquidity for market volatility. But now, let me tell you a horror story from our source stack. Anxious Andy gets a glossy brochure in the mail for a non-traded REIT. It promises a rock-solid 8% yield and shows a perfectly smooth chart demonstrating the price never drops, even in a crash. He wants to dump his life savings into this miracle product.
This is where you, as the licensed advisor, have to tackle Andy and save him from a catastrophic mistake. Non-traded REITs are incredibly dangerous products, fundamentally unsuited for retail investors with liquidity needs.
Let's start with a gotcha warning. The brochure says it is fully registered with the SEC. Does that mean it's safe and regulated?
That they are registered with the SEC, yes. They are legal to sell, but, and this is the critical trap, registered does not mean listed. They are registered with the government, but they do not trade on any public stock exchange.
So Andy can't just log into E-Trade and hit sell.
He cannot. There is no ticker symbol. Which brings us to the three heavily tested risks. Risk number one is total illiquidity. Andy is locked in. The sponsor might offer a limited redemption program, but the fine print always says they can cancel it at their complete discretion. Andy has to assume his principal is frozen for 7 to 10 years.
Anxious Andy would literally lose his mind if his life savings were frozen for a decade. Worst possible vehicle for him.
Total mismatch.
Risk number two, What are the friction costs to get into this exclusive deal?
The upfront fees are notoriously obscene. They are sold through complex broker networks that charge exorbitant commissions. It is incredibly common for 9 to 10% of the total investment to be cannibalized by fees on day one.
Wow. If Andy invests 100 grand, $10,000 vanishes instantly into the broker's pocket. Only 90 grand actually goes into the real estate. Cautious Carl would be physically ill reading that.
It creates a massive hurdle just to break even.
And that leads to the final, most insidious risk. Risk number 3, the fake yield. How can a non-traded REIT consistently pay an 8% distribution even during a recession when buildings are empty?
This is what the SEC issues warnings about. With a normal company, dividends are paid out of actual profits. But non-traded REITs are under pressure to maintain that 8% illusion. To do it, they are legally permitted to pay distributions out of the very principal the investors just contributed, or by borrowing from banks.
Wait, they take Andy's 100 grand and then just hand him 8,000 of his own dollars back a year later and call it an 8% yield.
Yeah. Exactly. On tax forms, it's classified as a return of capital. It's an illusion. It secretly destroys the underlying net asset value of the shares over time.
Yeah.
When the 10-year lockup ends, Andy might be horrified to discover his original 100 grand is only worth 50 grand because they slowly bled his own principal back to him.
That is horrifying. So if the exam describes a real estate investment with limited secondary liquidity, massive upfront commissions, and distributions from return of principal, you hammer non-traded REIT and move on.
Without hesitation. Those are the defining red flags.
Wow. We have successfully deconstructed a massive amount of plumbing today, from daily mutual fund NAVs to decade-long private equity lockups. Instead of a standard trivia recap, let's synthesize the why behind all of this.
I agree. When you look at all these pooled vehicles together, the entire system is basically a sliding scale of trade-offs between two things, control and liquidity.
Right. Let's track that. If anxious Andy demands ultimate daily liquidity, where he can get his cash out on a Tuesday afternoon without any secondary market weirdness, he has to choose an open-end mutual fund. But the trade-off is he loses control over tax consequences. He might inherit Cautious Carl's capital gains.
Exactly. Now, if Carl wants to seize control of those tax consequences, he moves to the ETF. The in-kind redemption process fields him. But the trade-off is he must now navigate the secondary stock exchange and accept whatever market price intraday trading dictates.
And if billionaire Betty wants ultimate control, meaning she wants her managers to literally buy entire companies, she moves to private equity. But the trade-off for that absolute control is the total destruction of liquidity. She has to accept capital calls, tying up her money for 10 years.
It is a perfect closed ecosystem. You cannot have maximum liquidity, maximum tax efficiency, and maximum strategic control all in the same vehicle. You have to choose which pain point your client can tolerate.
And that is exactly what the Series 66 exam is testing.
I'll leave you with one final thought to chew on. Today, for the sake of the exam, we put all these funds into neat little boxes. Public funds over here, private equity lockups over there. But the real financial world is mutating rapidly.
Oh, totally.
Massive private equity giants are actively building complex, retail-friendly mutual funds specifically designed to tap into anxious Andy's retirement money. At the same time, traditional active mutual fund managers are desperately converting their aging funds into ETFs to capture that tax efficiency.
The walls between these historical vehicles are completely collapsing.
They are. When you pass this exam, get your license, and sit across the desk from a real client, you won't just be picking a static vehicle from a 1940s textbook. You're going to be navigating a highly complex hybrid landscape where the lines separating public and private are disappearing entirely.
The textbook is just the starting line. Understanding the plumbing is how you survive the real game. You've got this. Good luck studying. And we will see you on the next deep dive.